And now it's time for Highlights from Christian History with Michael Goins. It has been said that a people that forgets its history loses its identity. And without a doubt, contemporary confusion about what it means to be a Christian, and even a Baptist, may be directly traced to the idea that the past is irrelevant to the modern world. In such a climate, intent on deconstructing history, we are more convinced than ever that an understanding of our rich history is of paramount importance. So we're glad that you've joined us for this edition of Highlights from Christian History. Here's Brother Goins with today's segment.
Today on Highlights from Christian History, we continue with the topic, The Age of Doctrinal Confusion. We're in AD 200 to 600. Arianism and the Council of Nicaea. Perhaps the most significant challenge to the doctrine of Christ's person came in the latter half of the 3rd century and first half of the 4th. A bishop from Alexandria, Egypt, named Arius, began to teach that Jesus was not God, but was the first and highest created being. He set his message to a catchy jingle, and soon people were singing in the streets, "Once the Son did not exist." Another Alexandrian, a theologian named Athanasius, countered Arius with a book entitled On the Incarnation of the Word of God, and debate between the two sides erupted. It is highly doubtful that Constantine cared about the deity of Christ. In fact, Constantine gave the opening speech at the council stating that doctrinal disunity was worse than war. But he did care about the unity of the empire, so Constantine arranged a council at Nicaea, a city he later named Constantinople, on July 4, 325 AD. Record indicates that 318 bishops were present. At first, one group stridently disagreed with Arius, but another supported him. The majority only wanted peace and thought the debate over the Greek words similar and same was immaterial. But when one of Arius's supporters took it upon himself to explain the Arian position, bedlam erupted and the council condemned the idea that Christ was created as blasphemy. An elder from Asia Minor named Marcellus suggested that the delegates use the Greek word Athanasius used to describe the person of Christ, that is to say, homoousion, meaning one and the same. By a vote of 316-2, the council adopted what has come to be known as the Nicene Creed, which declares Jesus Christ to be, quote, very God of very God, being of one substance with the Father, by whom all things were made, close quote. When Bible students today say that Christ is co-substantial and co-essential with the Father, they are taking a stand for Christian orthodoxy against the Arian heresy. This was a defining moment in Christian history, for it codified the important doctrine of Christ's deity and protected it against maverick interpretations. Some scholars have ridiculed the fact that the council split over one iota, the difference between the Greek word for similar, Arius's position, and the Greek word for same, Athanasius' position, is a single letter, the letter I. They claim it is just like theologians to debate trivial matters while neglecting the real-life problems that people face. But Dr. Erwin Lutzer from Moody Church in Chicago repeats a story that demonstrates how a single letter or mark of punctuation can change the meaning of a message. He writes, "Back in the days when messages were sent by telegraph, there was a code for each punctuation mark. A woman touring Europe cabled her husband to ask whether she could buy a beautiful bracelet for $75,000. The husband sent this message back, 'No, price too high.' The cable operator, in transmitting the message, however, missed the signal for the comma. So the woman received the message, 'No price too high.' She bought the bracelet. The husband sued the company and won. After that, people using Morse code spelled out all punctuation. Clearly, a comma or an iota can make a big difference when communicating a message." Of course, the Council of Nicaea did not invent the doctrine of Christ's deity any more than Sir Isaac Newton invented the law of gravity. They merely recognized and affirmed a doctrine that had been held by Christians long before the group of 300-plus bishops met. For example, Pliny's letter to the Emperor Trajan, dated circa AD 107, speaks of Christians joining together in singing hymns to Christ as to a deity. In AD 110, Ignatius, Bishop of Antioch, wrote, "There is one God who manifests himself through Jesus Christ, his Son." And Polycarp, Bishop of Smyrna, sent an epistle to the church at Philippi, circa AD 112 to 118, in which he assumes that those to whom it is addressed acknowledge the divinity of Jesus, his exaltation to heaven, and his subsequent glorification. Each of these extra-biblical references appears 2 centuries before the Council of Nicaea convened. Subsequent quotes from Justin Martyr, circa AD 150, who called Christ the Son and Apostle of God the Father and Master of all, Irenaeus, circa AD 177, who speaking of John 1:1 stated that all distinctions between the Father and the Son vanish, for the one God made all things through his word, and Tertullian, circa AD 200, who affirmed both a fully divine and fully human Christ, appear in the annals of history prior to Nicaea as evidence that the consensus of the primitive church was that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. Orthodoxy in terms of Christology has historically been defined by a Trinitarian formula that neither divides the nature nor confounds the persons of the Godhead. Nicaea survives as the most popular statement of that formula, but we can be certain, though no official documentation survives, that those detractors of Constantine, whose passion it was to pursue a pure church according to the apostolic pattern, also maintained a doctrine of Christ that affirmed both his divine and his human natures. Soteriology. It was also during this period that disputes arose concerning the doctrine of salvation. There are 2 primary soteriological developments during this era that are significant in Christian history. The first is Cyprian's famous dictum, extra ecclesiam nulla salus, that is, there is no salvation outside the church. Cyprian ministered in Carthage in approximately 255 AD. His dictum expresses the idea that the church, through word and sacrament, mediates, as the means or instrument, God's grace in salvation. Historically, the phrase means of grace, or media gratae, is common to both sacerdotal traditions, such as Catholicism, Anglicanism, Episcopalianism, who emphasize the sacramental acts as more or less salvific, and evangelical traditions, such as Lutheranism, Presbyterianism, and other Reformed traditions, who emphasize the preaching of the Word as the instrument of salvation. Though debate continues between the 2 schools of thought over which media should have priority, that is, the Word or the sacraments, yet both share a common conviction that salvation is mediated through the church, beyond which there is no salvation, extra ecclesiam nulla salus. But is the church a redemptive institution? In a word, did God make the equation of grace contingent on the variable of human instrumentality? Many Christian denominations today say yes. We Primitive Baptists believe, however, that the church is a disciplinary with respect to discipleship, pastoral with respect to ministry to God's people, not a redemptive, that is, with respect to eternal salvation, institution. Jesus Christ himself, not the church, is the one mediator between God and men, 1 Timothy 2:5, the only means by which the salvific benefits of the covenant of redemption are dispensed. Neither the preached word or the ordinances of the church have any role in eternal salvation, but are intended for the education, encouragement, and edification of believers in this world. This distinction between those who have bought in to Cyprian's dictum and those who insist that Jesus Christ is the only mediator of salvation is the primary difference between primitive Baptists and other Christian traditions today. Most groups accept Cyprian's formula as the truth. We believe that the church is intended for discipleship, not redemption. The second episode of note was a debate in about 420 AD between 2 monks, a Augustine of Hippo in North Africa, and Pelagius, a pious British monk. Pelagius denied original sin, insisting that Adam's sin did not affect the entire human race. At birth, he said, people are able to do everything that God requires of them if they will only exercise their will. The ability to be saved is resident in the heart of man, he taught. When his teachings reached Hippo, Augustine wasted no time. He countered Pelagianism in a work entitled Contra Duas Epistulas Pelagianorum. He argued from Paul's letters that Adam's original sin corrupted all humanity, and that this corruption is so extensive and radical that no one is naturally inclined toward God. He insisted that salvation must be by grace alone, not by man's free will, because of man's inherent depravity. Of course, Augustine broke from Pauline theology when he argued, consistent with Cyprian's idea discussed previously, that the rite of infant baptism would purify a person from inherent sin. He believed that saving grace would be mediated through the church. Nevertheless, this titanic struggle between the ideas of salvation by God's free grace and salvation by man's free will would set the theological pace for years to come. Still, some Christian people insist on a modified version of Pelagianism, saying that man is not totally depraved and can therefore save himself by some good work or some decision he makes. Others, taking their cue from Augustine, believe that man is hopelessly ruined because of sin. His only hope is an alien righteousness, that is, something outside of himself, bestowed upon him by the grace of God. The Novatians. A discussion of this turbulent period in Christian history would not be complete without a more specific look at those groups that conscientiously objected to the changes that were taking place under Constantine. As previously noted, documentation of groups in the Free Church tradition is comparatively scant because only the works of those who wrote against them survived. Some material is available, however, on the Novatians or Cathari, the pure. Hassel says, Novatian was a very learned and upright elder in the church at Rome. When in 251 AD another elder named Cornelius wanted to readmit people who had lapsed during the Decian persecution, Novatian opposed such laxity and discipline on the grounds that the church should be a communion of saints. Cornelius, the loose disciplinarian, prevailed, and Novatian and the minority withdrew from the majority to pursue the pure church. Hassel states, there can be no question that these were Baptist churches. They would receive no members from such loose societies except by rebaptizing them. He emphasizes that the initial separation was caused by a difference in discipline, not in doctrine. After the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, Constantine wrote letters enjoining universal conformity to its decrees. Soon he issued edicts against maverick groups he deemed to be heretics, whom he deprived of the liberty of meeting for worship either in public or private places. The Novatians were among those he targeted. These penal laws obliged them to lurk in corners and worship God in private. The Novatians were criticized for their strict gospel discipline, as well as for their refusal to revere the martyrs or ascribe virtue to their relics. Though Constantine labeled them as heretics, it is clear that their doctrine was very scriptural. Novatian himself wrote a work on the subject of the Trinity that is still extant. The heretical charge is due to their refusal to participate in what they believed to be ecclesiastical corruptions. The Donatists. Another group vilified as heretics are the Donatists, circa 310 AD. Donatus fell into disfavor with Constantine when he protested the marriage of church and state. Donatus asked, "What has the emperor to do with the church?" When Constantine granted religious toleration to Christians in the Edict of Milan, 312 AD, he particularly made an exception for the Donatists. They appealed to him to examine their doctrinal principles. Constantine responded by appointing a council of 20 bishops to do so in 313 and another council of 200 in 314. He even granted them a personal audience at Milan in 316. But each time, the Donatists were condemned and labeled as rebels for resisting the authority of the emperor. Edicts were issued depriving them of their church buildings and sentencing them to banishment, the confiscation of property, and even death. Hassell indicates that they advocated the purity and unworldliness of the church and the necessity of strict discipline. Like the Montanists and the Novatians, they baptized all whom they received into their churches, whether such had previously been professedly baptized or not. Their churches were independent of each other in government. In 411 AD, Augustine argued that the state had the responsibility to use force to bring them into conformity to Catholicism, but other political developments terminated the proposal before it could be executed. To this day, most historians refer to the Donatists as heretics, but it is evident that the issue of perspective is always relevant when charging someone with being a heretic. Any evidence that the Donatists were anything but sincere believers in apostolic Christianity is conspicuous by its absence. More could be said of those who conscientiously objected to the reforms being perpetrated on the Christian church, people like Tertullian and the Montanists, who withdrew from the increasingly institutionalized church because of its corruptions. But this is sufficient to establish the point that Catholicism was not the only option. It was by means of these various groups that were viewed as nonconformists and rebels that Christ preserved his church in that day of doctrinal confusion and change.
Thank you for joining us today for this brief snapshot from the past. Please join us again soon for another episode of Highlights from Christian History.